March Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my interview with Tony Lyons, the creator of Skyhorse Publishing. Tony, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good today. I'm really happy to be chatting with you. Thank you for calling in from New York.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon, broadcast at 11 a.m. every Saturday and 3 p.m. on Tuesdays at 101.9 FM KVSH. It's also available online 24/7 at voiceofvashon.org, or you can swing by my website, marchtwisdale.com, and get tons of information there. I even have a podcast that just got started this week. So, Tony, we're going to dive right in. We've got a beautiful laundry list here of cool things we're going to talk about. Can you go ahead and give our listeners a sense of who you are?
Sure. So my name is Tony Lyons, and I founded Skyhorse Publishing 10 years ago. Prior to that, I was a lawyer and have worked in the publishing field for 25 years. Skyhorse has about 95 people working here. We have 14 imprints. Pretty much across the spectrum of publishing.
So we got a whole bunch of cool stuff we're going to chat about, and one of the books that your assistant sent to me is Touch the Earth by Julian Lennon. And I think, is this one already available, or is it about to be available?
The pub date was yesterday.
Haha, perfect.
And Julian Lennon was on the Today Show in People Magazine. He's going to be on The View, has been on a bunch of other shows. And it's a very early childhood book. It's a picture book, and it's meant to teach children about the importance of the environment, of mm-hmm. protecting it, and of maintaining it. And we think it's a lovely way to sort of develop a sensitivity towards trying to protect the planet for themselves and for their own children.
He created the White Feather Foundation?
Right. Some of the proceeds go to that foundation.
What is it that Skyhorse Publishing sees itself having as sort of a role in society?
Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, my feeling is that there are many subjects that are just not covered by the mainstream media, or when they are covered, they're covered in an incredibly myopic way. So when it comes to politics, I favor publishing books that show some alternative view, not necessarily Skyhorse having a specific point of view that we're trying to get out there, but trying to publish books that are provocative in the sense that they question the prevailing view. So, you know, for example, we published a book in October before the election called The Plot to Hack America by mm-hmm. Malcolm Nance, and it was a very successful book. Malcolm was on probably 40 or 50 TV shows. That started out, I mean, when I first heard about it, it was kind of cutting-edge news. And I was fascinated by that, and I decided to bring that book out really, really quickly. So we put a whole team of people on it, and we published it in about 10 days.
Wow.
And then for the next 4 or 5 months, it became pretty much just 24/7 news, you mm-hmm. know, that every bad thing that had ever happened in the United States from the beginning of time up until the election of Donald Trump was because of the Russians.
Right.
And so then I started to become open to the idea that, you know, at the very least, maybe we were going too far mm-hmm. with this sort of anti-Russian mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of that came a book that we're just publishing now, which is called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. You know, so I don't feel that my role is to tell anybody which of those two narratives is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
What I feel like my role is to bring up the issue that there is a different side to this story,
mm-hmm.
and that if you're really going to think versus just sort of spout out what you hear on television,
mm-hmm.
you have to have both sides of a story.
Right, or all five sides of a story
exactly.
sometimes. Yeah.
Definitely.
Well, I think it is such a mark of integrity. You just have this great opportunity to take the power of publishing and use it to bring the less often heard thoughts and ideas up into the public platform for discussion and awareness building.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, and you know, some of the time, I don't think it's necessary to publish on both sides. So if we hadn't published the first book on the plot to hack America, I don't think I would want to publish that now, because that story is so mainstream that it's not as exciting now as it would have been at the time.
Right.
Whereas now the fascinating story for me is the alternative story, the story that rounds out people's ability to actually think through the state of the country.
Right. And there's a lot of thinking that's needed right now in America, for sure.
Definitely.
Which reminds me of the fact that 1984, written in the 40s or 50s, just had, you said, a huge upsurge and became the number one selling book in America, like for 2 or 3 weeks after the election.
Right.
Is that true?
Yeah, I was really fascinated by that, and my take on it was a bit different than many people who I talked to, and many people sort of in the mainstream news business. And that was that part of what's happening now is that, you know, even though there are lots of things that Trump is doing now that I think are unconscionable, and we have a book called Horsemen of the Apocalypse that's coming out by Dick Russell and Robert F. Kennedy Jr.,
right.
And that's just coming out this week, and that details some of the tragedies that are going on as far as things that are happening that are going to impact the environment, the water, the air.
Right.
You know, those are critical and very serious problems that I think we all need to fight against. I'm very proud to be publishing that book.
Yeah.
But I think that there's another side to this whole story, which is that much of the left's view towards Russia, for example, seems to be so absolute and so certain. So I think that it's this uniformity of belief on both sides without facts, really, but with an incredible amount of repetition, so that even the concept of fake news is happening equally on both sides.
Yeah. It's been really eye-opening for me to watch humans under pressure. That's what I like to refer to it as, is how do humans behave under pressure? Because you could go out there, I think, and have the same mantra repeated, like you were saying earlier, a message just goes on and on and on. But if it's not something that triggers people or they don't have a reason to care, that message isn't going to stick in their head. I think ultimately what we have is a lot of very fearful people who are under pressure, and they're looking to relieve their anxiety and their fear, and that means they want an answer. And in that moment, they want a simple answer, a confident answer. You've got the same desire for simple, pat answers to very complex problems.
Definitely. And, I mean, we published one book called The Gilded Rage.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
Alexander Zaitchik, and he's a Democrat who followed the Trump campaign and met with Trump voters all around the country before the election, went out and had beers with them, listened to their point of view, and sort of started to get the point that most Democrats weren't getting, that most of the people who were voting for Trump weren't the types of people who were described on CNN, you know, that they were not racist, they were not homophobic. You know, they were...
Was that word that she used? They were not the deplorables?
They were not the deplorables. They were smart people who had real, sincerely held gripes that they could describe and that they did describe. And they told stories about how they had lost their jobs and about how the places that they lived had deteriorated, and their hopes for the future had deteriorated. And these are real stories of sincere people hoping that Trump would actually bring jobs back to America.
Right.
And point of the book is that, you know, these are disabled vets or machinists from Wisconsin where the factory closed down, or construction workers in Pennsylvania,
Michigan.
Or miners in West Virginia.
Right.
You know, you get the point. you know, these are real people with real problems that were not being addressed. And it's a counterintuitive thing because you would think that Democrats would be much more likely to want to help people who are out of work.
Mm-hmm.
And these people felt that they had been left by the wayside and that the Democrats sort of had this globalist view and, you know, didn't care about the side effects of some of these policies.
Right. And what's really, I mean, what's fascinating is that given what happened in the beginning of Obama's term when he bailed out the banks, essentially the wealth class, and given that he and Hillary Clinton were, you know, globetrotting to push
TPP.
Okay. And they've
Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Right, and they've been out pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is just sort of like NAFTA on steroids. So, ironically, a person who's paying attention over the last, well, 8 to 16 to 20 years has some really good reasons to not trust the Democratic Party to look out for the little guy. People have a sense that you're either liberal or conservative. And I always try to say, no, there's economics and there's social issues. And you can be liberal or conservative on either of those. And the Democratic Party has become more and more conservative when it comes to the economic piece while maintaining liberal views on social issues. And people go, oh, you know, they support gay rights. Yay, they must be, quote, all liberal. But on the economics, when you look at the facts, they're still very conservative. And there you go. The poor people are getting poorer.
Sure. And then, you know, to a great extent, you know, whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, you know, has much less to do with how you as an individual think.
Right.
You know, it has much, much more to do with where you grew up and what your parents think and where you live now.
What I found fascinating, I was the lead area caucus coordinator for my entire island. We had about 2,000 people who showed up for the caucus. So I spent about 500 human hours organizing this event. We had like 60 volunteers in the day of. It was huge. It consumed my life. And what I found fascinating when I did this is it brought me directly in touch with the local Democratic Party. And I've never really engaged so much with them. I'm an activist, but I haven't engaged with like the party loyalists, right? And I was amazed at how much hate speech that would be directed towards, quote, Republicans. And it was so startling because I know people in my community who are brilliant, wonderful, moral, ethical, loving, kind Republicans. They're great. And then these people would just like venom is dripping into their cup of coffee. And I'm just sitting there thinking, I never would have known that anyone could think so harshly of someone based upon their political party alignment. It was pretty eye-opening.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually really deeply boring to sort of even think that so many people have the point of view that they're two kinds of people in the United States.
Right.
You know, and, you know, that one is good and one is bad, you know. I hope that it's more complicated than that.
I know, right? Definitely. Definitely.
I mean, one of the books that we published just a couple of months ago was a book by Roger Stone, who was a close friend and confidant of President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book called The Making of the President, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being from New York, you can imagine that many people wondered why I would want to publish this book. And
especially given the subtitle, How Donald Trump Orchestrated a Revolution.
Right.
So let's be clear. This is definitely a We Like Donald Trump book, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And it's in pretty sharp contradiction to the political point of view of the guy who wrote The Gilded Rage, even though that winds up sort of explaining to Democrats who some of the Republican voters are.
Right.
But, you know, what fascinated me with this story is that this is the inside story by somebody who was part of it, who was talking directly to the president
mm-hmm.
on how they actually won the election. Mm-hmm. And it's somehow is a bunch of little stories and a bunch of turning points in various regions of the country on certain specific issues mm-hmm. that haven't been addressed, really. You know, that it's so much easier to just say, well, it's all about Russia, or it's somehow fraud, or people are all racist or sexist, and that's why Clinton lost. And so I was fascinated with his story, which I think is his real story of how he thinks it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea of being able to add that piece of the puzzle,
right.
of maybe future elections are going to be looked at differently based on this book. So what you get from Roger Stone's book are the stories of the fight for those people who aren't decided. And it's a relatively small number. And elections in each state
right.
are, you know, often won or lost by 10,000 votes or 30,000 votes. So if you have a specific strategy of how to talk to a specific kind of voter in a specific state,
right,
that can change the whole outcome.
There was a young man in, I think, the Puyallup region, basically just near here, who wanted to become representative, not a senator, but a representative for his district. And he didn't have a bunch of money. So he spent 2 years walking all of the streets of his area and knocking on doors and talked to thousands upon thousands of people at their front doorstep. And at the next election, he was voted in.
Yeah.
And I don't think he put, like, any money into posters or, you know, or anything like that. So that was his way of finding the voters.
Right. Makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. But then there are stories that something like 25% of Trump voters were, it's 25% of people who were going to vote for Bernie Sanders wound up voting for Trump.
That wouldn't surprise me. There were a lot of people who they weren't going to vote establishment no matter what.
Yeah, and there was a big percentage of Donald Trump voters who were, you know, whose main issue was the TPP and,
mm-hmm.
and NAFTA.
There are some people who just couldn't go there. I mean, if you've been devastated by NAFTA already, you can't support the person who's pushing TPP. And Hillary was referring to it as the gold standard. And then they did a Freedom of Information Act request for all the documents that Hillary had produced as our servant, as Secretary of State, regarding TPP. And it was going to be provided. This was like in May, heading into the California primaries. And then the Obama administration said, you know, we've decided to actually refuse to distribute that information until after the election in November. And at that moment, it was like, because we've got something to hide. I mean, it was like this, and, you know, it was a bad year.
Yeah, it's a lot of crazy stuff. But,
yeah.
You know, like I said, I mean, I don't see my role as sort of trying to convince anybody of anything, to put the information out there on both sides in certain cases and in other cases just on the side that I think isn't covered and might be valid.
Right. So back to what it's like to be
president and publisher.
There you go. Excellent. That is a really hard job.
You guys
are not sitting around eating bonbons and, you know, just watching the books roll out. I mean, this is hard work.
No, I mean, it's a round-the-clock job, and, you know, I don't think somebody takes this kind of job on unless they just love it. And, you know, for me, when I look around at the books here that I really like, there's a story from, you know, almost all of them. You know, there's a book that we published a few years ago about a white man who was pretty well off in Washington State who lost all of his money and became homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And an old friend of mine called up and said that he was sitting with the homeless writer of this book, and he wondered if I would fly out to Washington State because he said that he had read it and he thought that I would love it. And I flew out there and I met with the writer Mm-hmm. And some representatives from the Salvation Army who had also read it and really loved it and wanted to sort of send him on a tour to teach the world that homelessness can strike anybody.
Absolutely.
And I flew out there, met with all of them for something like 4 or 5 hours, brainstormed a campaign, and then published the book, which then got a rave in the New York Times, wound up selling really, really well.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Breakfast at Sally's.
Oh, I've heard that title.
One Homeless Man's Inspirational Journey.
And yeah.
The author's name is Richard Lemieux.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a fascinating and uplifting guy, but just had a really tough time of it.
Yeah.
But just tells a beautiful and moving story.
You know, I may call him up and see if he's willing to be on the show, because it is a travesty what's happening right now in the city of Seattle, and obviously probably in the entire state of Washington. But Seattle is awash in a homeless camp, and everyone's getting so used to it. You know, you've got the millionaire mansions that are like exploding on the east side, and at the same time, of course, you're going to have over here in Seattle, you have the explosion of homelessness. So we have these two things happening. Literally, you know, it'll be on the front page of the newspaper that the police are driving people out of their homeless camp number 5, number 3. There's like 6 of them, you know, and they just show up and they give them 3 hours to pack up and move. People who have been in a location for about 1 or 2 months maybe. And so they've started accumulating things that they've been able to find, like maybe a couch or certain heavy objects. And then they're given 3 hours to pick up and move. And they have to leave behind, like, you know, 80% of the stuff that they've created to give themselves a nest, a place to be safe and secure. And it's just on the front page. And there's no response. It's as if people are becoming numb to the idea, which is really scary.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's a great person to have that conversation with, because there are all kinds of reasons why people wind up on the streets, and he's just a wonderful spokesman for it.
Tony, I'm going to take a break here for a second so that everyone who's just joined us through the middle of the show will know that they are listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. My name is March Twisdale, producer and host, and I am talking with Tony Lyons, the president and publisher of Skyhorse Publishing. I would like to take a couple of minutes to give a shout out to those who make Voice of Vashon possible. Support comes from Vashon Theater, the island's one and only movie house since 1947, striving to have something for everyone. The Vashon Theater has expanded their offerings to include national theater, Bolshoi Ballet, and art and architecture series as well. Information about all films at VashonTheater.com. Watch locally. And we have support for VOV programming by Mostly True Vashon Tours. Based on the popular Mostly True History book series, these tours offer a lighthearted perspective on the island's past with visits to actual historical event locations. Along the way, you experience all that Vashon has to offer in the way of local food, spirits, and recreation. Information and tickets are at VashonTours.com or the Hinge Gallery, located at Vashon Highway and 174th Ave, right near downtown. All right, folks, so we're going to dive back into this interview. Thank you again so much, Tony, for joining me. And I'm loving the New York ambiance background noises.
Yeah, there's a lot of drilling and honking and all that sort of stuff.
I know. At one point, there was like a honk. There was like a honk. And there was like a honk. It was like I could just imagine three people like sort of glaring at each other. Where are you located in New York?
We're on 37th Street and 8th Avenue. It's about as noisy and bustling as you can possibly find in the five boroughs.
Got it. As in like no one would ever drive to work?
No, definitely not.
Okay. I love it.
Quicker to walk.
You know, I haven't been to New York, and I'm going to have to go at some point.
Let me know when you get here. We can definitely give you a tour.
Yeah, I would love that. Okie doke, so you sent me another book, The Hamilton Affair, which most of you out there listening right now have probably heard of the Broadway show. Isn't it like one of the best ever? I mean, it's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely an incredibly well-viewed play.
So Elizabeth Cobbs wrote this book. It is a novel. So this is basically historical fiction?
Right.
And what do you love about this? You sent it to me. You wanted to chat about it. What's great?
It's a beautifully written book, and it's it's on a topic that people really care about now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had decided to publish it about a year before the play became world famous.
Got it.
To some extent there, it was good luck, which sometimes happens in publishing. Most of publishing is really, really hard work and not a great return. But every now and then you get something like this where there's a windfall.
Yeah, the stars align, so to speak.
Definitely.
This is so great because what I love about living here on Vashon is that we've got this great bookshop and they have a display set up for Prose, Poetry, and Purpose and also my new show, Focus On. And so this book is a review copy of The Hamilton Affair and it'll be sitting in the Vashon bookshop for anyone on the island who wants to swing by and look through this book. I also hope everyone checks out your website. So skyhorsepublishing.com. So Skyhorse Publishing still runs like a startup. And I was wondering, for all of my listeners out there who are engaged themselves in hoping to publish or already published, and we've all been talking about over the last 8 to 10 years, the struggles that the big publishing houses have been having. You guys are doing really good over the last decade. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, so my feeling of how Skyhorse works and why we've been doing pretty well when some other places haven't been doing quite as well is mostly that we're open to a very wide range of books that we're willing to, in many cases, do more work than other publishers are, in the sense that that we sometimes pick a topic first and then go out and try to find somebody who will work with us to write that. And much of how the company runs is sort of stream of consciousness, that if there's a topic that's in the news, somebody might come in and say, we should really do a book on that, and then think about, you know, who can we get to go out and do that quickly.
So Jonathan Tessini was interviewed about a year ago on the show, and he wrote The Essential Bernie Sanders, and it took him, I think, about 30 days to write the book. And I was really blown away, but you know, he's been writing his whole life. This is what he does. And he said, yeah, I basically just, everything else in my life got dropped. And I wrote this book in 30 days because I found out Bernie Sanders was running for president and we needed to have this information out there, and bam. So you're saying that when there's a really important issue and that's being missed or whatever, that you can sort of like put out feelers and find people who would be just right to tackle that concept?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit more, you know, when you talk of a startup mentality, I mean, we might have five different people searching for somebody who can write a specific kind of book and try to get that wrapped up in 24 hours. You know, whether it's a political book of some kind or, you know, even if it's some sort of fad or, you know, practical book that we think is going to sell really well.
I've always heard the standard idea, you know, you're looking at least 18 months before the book is going to hit the shelves.
Yeah, and that's rapidly changing. You know, for example, there's a writer named Terry Goodkind whose books have sold something like 20 million copies in the last 30 years.
Wow.
And he came to me last fall and said that he had read that we could get books out quickly and that he really wanted us to get this book out in about 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a serious thriller with a political twist to it. And so he wanted it to come out, you know, during the fall political season.
Sure.
And we wound up doing it. And that was a case where he probably could have published it with, you know, any of the big publishers if he'd been willing to wait 18 months.
Right.
So one of the things about a startup mentality or about a small publishing company is that we have to be able to offer something that other people can't or don't want to. And one of the things we can do is that during that period, I was on the phone with Terry Goodkind at 2 in the morning some of the time, you know, doing anything we could possibly do to get that book out quickly so that when he thinks back on it, he thinks, you know, Skyhorse really can do this. And then he goes and tells people and we've then made a friend for the next 20 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's such a good point. You need to be able to, you know, offer something that other people don't have available to them. And I think when people think of a startup, they think of This is really sort of an analogy for politics as well, or governance, is that a startup doesn't have any of the baggage of the old ways that people are used to doing things. And when I think of publishing houses been around for 60 years or something, that they've already got so much institutionalized in how they operate, that just trying to do things new and different, it's got to be a whole bunch more work, because you're having to actually deconstruct at the same time that you construct.
Right. And we always are trying to learn how to do things better, you know, to try not to be constrained by the way people have done things in the past. So some of the time it's even difficult to hire somebody from one of the big companies, because they come to Skyhorse and they want to do it more slowly, or they want to do it in the way that it's always been done. And I don't mind doing things in the way that they've always been done, but I always want to be open to some new way.
Well, it's obviously working. Do you have a sense of how things are going in general with the entire arena of publishing?
I mean, my sense is that there's a lot of pressure for bigger and bigger books and bigger deals. And I'm sure many of the people who are listening to this read about the $65 million Obama two-book deal.
Yeah, I hadn't actually heard of that. You mentioned that earlier. So
it's a two-book deal for $65 million. And you just think about...
Meaning Obama got $65 million.
Right. It's the most money that's ever been paid for two books in the history of mankind. You know, so that's probably a pretty tough pill to swallow for, you know, many writers out there who work for years and years on something that really come from their heart, and then they publish it. It might even get raves, and it's quite possible that it still only sells 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 copies.
And especially when the publishers are telling the writers, we don't have a budget for promotion, you're going to have to promote the book yourself because we're struggling economically to survive here. And then the writers hear that they just managed to come up with $65 million for two books.
Right.
Oh, I see the bitterness there,
What they get with a former president is that they know that the Obamas can get on television all day after day, when the book comes out.
Right.
And they also know they're going to sell it in, you know,
every country in the world.
Exactly.
Wow, that's fascinating.
So I think that what they're really doing is that, even though that's a huge number and it's sort of shocking to a publisher like me, and it's shocking to writers all around the world, I think that the reality of book publishing now is that they probably figure out that that's less risky than publishing somebody's first novel, even if they're paying $2,000 for it. It's a huge number, but you know, they look at it on a spreadsheet that they're going to sell it in 100 countries,
right,
and get X dollars from each country. And they've seen what past presidents' books have sold.
Right.
I was told that Bush's book sold something like 7 million copies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's something like $100 million in sales.
I know when authors are sitting around crunching numbers and stuff like that, it's, you know, they'll be like, I'm lucky to make 75 cents when a book sells, or something like that.
Right.
That's
author. Definitely true.
Yeah.
I mean,
wow.
Most authors clearly, you know, would make much more money doing almost anything else. And that's true with a lot of people who work in the publishing field, too. You know, my brother wrote a book that he spent 3 years writing, and the book sold, I think, 1,000 copies.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a book that he really wanted to write and that he really cared about.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't like he was doing something he didn't like doing for the hope of an economic outcome later. I mean, it was part of the enjoyment of his life at the time.
Yeah. I mean, even the couple of novels that he wrote were, you know, things that he just took so much joy in writing, that the fact that he didn't make much money on it, I think, wasn't a crushing blow for him. That's not why he wrote them.
Right. I really like, I mean, basically on the website here, these little images of books are floating past and they keep catching my attention as we're chatting. And I can't help, I have to mention, I love it. You've got Minecraft books.
Right. So we do a whole series of novels that are based on the Minecraft game, you know, that sort of take place in a Minecraft world. And we started doing those, I think, 3.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One of the fascinating things there is that we've gotten tons of letters from parents saying that that their kids read their first book as one of that series, that they were hooked on Minecraft, and that the parents then negotiated with the children to read a book, get them away from, you know, playing Minecraft for one more hour, and have them then read a book so that they could play more Minecraft.
Right. I know. It's a problem. I have two kids who are 15 and 18 right now, and I play computer games with them because it's what they're enjoying doing, and I like to do what my kids like to do. And it's funny, you know, I'll talk to parents who have not played Minecraft, and all they'll ever talk about is how the graphics are horrible. And then I'll talk to someone who has not played League of Legends, and they'll be like, oh, I don't know, it's just a game. And I'm like, yeah, no, this is League of Legends, man.
Right.
And Minecraft, I spent years playing Minecraft with the kids, and you get to know, like, and I just want to mention this because a lot of my listeners out there are probably exactly that type of person who has a vague sense of this, and if you're at all hostile towards computer games, you're going to think it's all a waste of time. And I do think reading, especially fiction, which builds empathy, is extremely important. So I'm a big reader, obviously. But with Minecraft, you're playing with people from around the world. So
sure.
For me, I would end up talking to people, like I'd play with the same people from about 10 o'clock at night until 1 a.m., right? And these are people who were soldiers who had been based in Okinawa, Japan, or people who lived in Australia. So you end up meeting people from entirely different continents, and you'll spend months sort of chatting with these people and knowing what's going on in their lives while you're running around hacking, you know, zombies and stuff like that. So
right.
It's Minecraft can be really, really fun. Anyway, so
I love books. It's a fascinating game, and it's clearly a game that has longevity. You know, that it's very, very different than those kind of fads like the, you know, Rainbow Loom thing that was banned from schools all across the country when for about a 2-month period that's all kids did.
Really? Banned it?
Yeah, it was banned from all the public schools in New York City. I mean, I'm not sure about other cities and states, but it was a big thing here that schools figured that that kids needed to blow off steam, that the whole point of recess was to run around.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that all the kids brought their rainbow looms with them
and sat down and did artwork during their break,
that they should just be, you know, sprinting around, running, climbing, jumping.
It's your
so
free
that they
could time
come back and concentrate
we're,
again.
Yeah, it's your free time, so we're going to tell you how to spend your free time.
Right. Yeah, I'm not for any kind of banning or censorship, but it was sort of a fascinating thing. But Minecraft is something much different in that it involves so much creativity.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like a different form of Lego.
Yeah.
You know, that's been around for, 50 years.
Or just plain old art. I mean, you've probably been online and scrolled through, and you'll have groups of people who will get together. These are adults or teens, usually, who have real artistic interest, and they will design these. We're talking, like, probably millions of blocks are used in these huge, giant paintings, basically, that are made in this Minecraft world. And they'll spend you know, a few days as a team of 10 working on something and produce some huge octopus or something that it's amazing.
Yeah. So the role that the Minecraft novels play is that they let people get used to reading by luring them in through something that they already like.
Sure.
And then it also gives Minecraft players all kinds of ideas about things that they can do once they go back to the game.
Mm-hmm.
So they both sort of benefit each other.
Oh, that's a great idea. That's so cool. And that's a good example, I think, of recognizing that something's really current moment, very fabulous and wonderful. And Skyhorse Publishing, did you guys get approached by the person who wrote these? Or is this an example of you said, hey, we should do this. Let's go find someone. And you generated
the
series.
Right. So we went out and found people. We saw that the game was doing really, really well. And
mm-hmm.
we were the first publisher who started doing them, and then we published something like 100 of them. Now lots of other publishers publish them too, so it's,
right.
it's like a whole genre, it's a whole section in many bookstores now.
I know, right? Very cool. Okay, so we have time to discuss one more book before our interview time is going to be over. Sadness. This is called A Patient's Guide to Unnecessary Knee Surgery.
Yeah, so that's a book that I really love, both in the sort of the concept of it, that it's subject matter that's not really covered. So, you know, I'm middle-aged and periodically trying to lose weight, get in shape, you know, be more healthy.
Right.
So my brother and I made a pact that we would run 6 miles a day for 10 days, having not run for something like 6 months.
So let's pause for a second for all of my listeners to collectively go, oh, no, because we're all groaning in anticipation here. So you had this lovely idea that we can all relate to. And what happened?
Right. So it's, you know, it's a personality problem. It, you know, is some of the good part of Skyhorse and some of the bad part, that we work really hard. We, you know, try to be creative. We go all out.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the time we do things, you know, too quickly or too long hours, and,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't pan out just as we hope.
Right.
And that's what happened here.
Yes.
So what happened is I was running up a hill and I felt an incredible pain in my knee, and then I couldn't walk for a couple of days. And the surgeon at the hospital, you know, looking at the X-ray and the MRI, said to me that I had done such incredible damage that if I didn't have surgery right away, I'd probably never run again and possibly not even be able to walk,
right.
Other than by getting a total knee replacement. So,
that's a scary piece of news to get.
Yeah, so then he walked me into his secretary and said that I should schedule the surgery right away. And I said, well, I'm going to, you know, take a couple of days to talk to somebody else. And he said that if I did any walking on it, I would probably do damage, and then I might, you know, be not only on crutches for a long time after the surgery, but, you know, might even have to have a wheelchair for a while. And it just sounded really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Sounded like, you know, like the kind of news that you know, changes your whole year around.
Mm-hmm.
But then I went and talked to my brother, and he had heard of a doctor who had sort of different views on surgery. And he thought, you know, this is the perfect guy to go talk to, because he thinks that generally surgery ought to be a last resort.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to see him, and he looked at all the slides and the functional MRI, and he said that it looked terrible and that I probably really would need surgery, but that he recommended that I just try to wait, and that the benefit of waiting is that each person's different and that I might just heal. And that
mm-hmm.
if I healed, I would, you know, save the trauma to my body, save being on crutches for months and months,
right.
save, you know, months and months of PE. And so what happened is I decided to take his word for it. And I limped around for a while. I tried to walk as little as I possibly could, and I found that after about 3 weeks, it started to heal just a bit,
mm-hmm.
and then it got better and better, and I started walking 3 or 4 miles on it slowly, and then I started walking with a backpack, and then I started jogging once again, and now I can jog 5 miles once again. So out of that experience came the book, The Handbook of Unnecessary Knee Surgery, because I really wanted to.
Written by the doctor that you worked with, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was such an incredible sort of feeling that here I had a very high-level, highly recommended surgeon at probably the best-known hospital in the United States for knee surgery,
mm-hmm.
Who was telling me that there was no way that I could avoid knee surgery. And, you know, the result was that I actually did avoid it and that my knee is fine.
Right. Well, definitely, worth putting into a book and making available for other people around the world.
Right. So now, you know, anyone who's thinking that they definitely need knee surgery, you know, can read his analysis of why what often looks like it's critical and requires surgery right away often doesn't. And that there are also many other ways to treat something like a really bad knee problem. And
right.
You know, so for example, my ex-wife does something called neuromovement, and it's a kind of non-invasive therapy that almost, you know, looks like massage.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to be really, really helpful in training the body to rely on different muscles and on its own structure to not only heal but to then prevent future damage. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that I felt is worthy of publishing books on, you know, when there's something that's just not covered and when the mainstream view is that you should just do what your doctor tells you, you know, which I think in, you know, a lot of cases you should do. But in this particular type of case, it's certainly worth considering.
I think isn't it fascinating, you know, how when we are faced with a person in a position of authority, there's a huge inclination to just automatically assume that we no longer need to go get that second opinion or understand it ourselves or check into it. Humans just have a real innate instinct to behave differently when there's an authority figure in the room. I think what happened on the United Airlines flight recently, where the person was dragged off the plane. Did you catch that? Like in the last 48 hours that happened?
Yes.
You know, there's been a lot of conversation about how the passengers on the plane could have or should have or whatever responded. And some people have said, you know, why didn't people like jump up and say, stop, this is wrong. And there's the one side, which is you don't want to like get arrested yourself or something. But also I think that everyone knows when you get on a plane, you are legally bound to obey the flight attendants. You're in an environment where they have authority over you and you've agreed to that. And so I think a lot of people just, they might have been horrified, taken video, been really upset, maybe they're not going to fly on the airline again, but they didn't feel like they were in a position where they had the power or the right to stand up and say, stop.
Definitely. And it's hard. I mean it's hard to stand up, and it's hard to have a view that most people disagree with.
Right.
And you know, that's kind of how I got on this show, that you had James Lyons Weiler,
yeah,
who wrote a book called The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which to me ought to be a very mainstream book and ought to be a very mainstream concept, that any kind of medical procedure requires thought and requires the ability to recognize that each patient is different.
Right.
And that, you know, people come to a doctor with different genetic predispositions, with different allergies, you know, with different immune systems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if you go to a doctor who treats all of his or her patients as if they're the same person, you could wind up with some very serious problems.
Right.
And, you know, so reading a book like Lyons Weiler's book, you get the sense that autism, like anything else, you know, has a genetic basis. But then again, so does almost anything that happens to you. And then it requires some kind of environmental trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that we all just need to be open to the fact that this is a pretty new problem in the United States, that went from 1 in 10,000 people to, you know, something like 1 in 68.
Right.
And that there clearly are some triggers, and we need to figure out what those triggers are.
Right.
And we're doing a real disservice to our children to assume that what doctors are telling us, which is illogical, which is just that it's a genetic condition and it's sort of a time bomb and it's going to happen to certain people and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
And one of the things that Dr. Weiler points out is that his research shows that vaccines can play a role, as can other things.
Right.
And and that's a fascinating story, and it's a story that the mainstream media kind of treats as settled, and you're supposed to believe that something that doctors and scientists can't explain is still somehow settled.
Right.
And that's a scary concept. I mean, it's a scary concept in the same way that scapegoating Russia is. It doesn't prove that the thing that you're hearing is necessarily wrong, but
right.
it proves in a kind of a 1984 type way that you're told time after time that something's true, and you don't demand any real facts.
Right.
And you just follow it.
You know, it's so simple in a way, is if you look back in history and almost everything that was done in the past that is not done today was at one point believed by the majority, the vast majority, to have value. So, you know, George Washington was essentially bled to death, you know, when he died, because the majority opinion of the medical community was that you should bleed your patients in order to balance the humors and all this other stuff. And now we know it's completely inaccurate. Well, the only way we could know what we know now is that at that time, the majority of people had to be wrong, and a very small minority challenged the majority viewpoint and ended up being correct. So to me, the concept of science is that science innately evolves except when we get in its way.
Right.
If we don't get in the way of scientific exploration and experimentation and discovery, which is all based upon asking any question that you want to ask and setting up a proper study to explore it, if we don't get in the way of that, we will continually get better and better information.
Sure.
But sometimes fear gets in the way.
Any serious scientist knows that science has to always be on the table. That science is never settled.
Right.
That anyone who's gone through medical school knows and says when they think about it that half the things that they learned in medical school wound up being wrong. That
yeah.
20, 30 years later, the science just so shows something different. And, you know, that's what's so scary. You know, with some of the big decisions that we make, like we published a book called The GMO Deception,
right,
by Shelley Krimsky.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's a case where we're led to believe that, or, you know, many, many people write about the fact that GMOs are just always safe. And
mm-hmm.
since GMOs are just sort of a concept, it's a way of modifying things, they might be perfectly fine in certain cases, but they might also be really earth-shattering
mm-hmm.
in the sense that they could change the whole history of mankind if we make a big genetic modification that turns out to be wrong and that
yeah.
out to be dangerous. So it's another one of those things that's never settled, that
mm-hmm.
we should be doing it and we should be trying to make things better, but we should do it very, very cautiously.
Well, and what's really fascinating about genetically modified organisms is that not all, but a significant number of them are designed specifically to be able to withstand glyphosate, which is what Roundup is. And
right.
so, for example, Japan will not grow genetically modified soybeans because what they, or China, it's one of those countries, what they discovered was that the GMO Roundup Ready soy plants don't grow as well as natural soy plants. They will withstand the glyphosate that's, you know, sprayed all over the fields, but they don't actually perform as well as a plant. So I think it was China said, no, we're not going to grow that here. It's so cool that you at Skyhorse Publishing are making room for books that ask the challenging questions.
Sure. And, you know, when you talk about something like glyphosate, you know, I've been following that story too. And I followed it when it was when the news hit last year that that the WHO had a panel of 100 scientists who believe that that glyphosate is a likely carcinogen and that it probably causes cancer. And, you know, basically that's a story that the American mainstream media didn't like and didn't cover.
Mm-hmm.
And you can, you know, go into any, you know, major, you know, Home Depot type store in the United States and you see stacks and stacks of Roundup.
Right.
That, you know, that are banned in most Western countries.
Right.
And here it's just, you know, on everybody's lawn.
And Costco has it all over the place. Springtime comes along and poof, there's Roundup everywhere.
So my response to that was we need to do a book on glyphosate.
Mm-hmm.
So we have just signed up a book on glyphosate and it's going to be coming out probably later this year or early 2018.
That is awesome. Yay!
And I will send it to you.
Thank you. Please do. That's so brilliant. Oh, Tony, this has been a wonderful interview.
Thank you so much for contacting me. I just, love to have the chance to talk about these kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just, you know, really grateful to people like you who go out there and with their time on this planet and with their life and their career are able to sort of pursue their passions and try to make the world better for everyone else at the same time.
Thanks for saying that.
Yeah. All right, folks, that's our show for today. My name is March Twisdale, and you've been listening to my interview with Tony Lyons, the founder of Skyhorse Publishing, where you can find a wide variety of books, genres, and viewpoints all in one place. Go to skyhorsepublishing.com, or if you live here on the island, drop by the Vashon Bookshop, and I'm going to have a couple of their books out there on the Prose, Poetry, and Purpose display. I'd like to thank you all for joining me today for another episode of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guests share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. And now, I'll leave you with the inspirational and timely song, We Are the Many, created by musical activist Makana.
You come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite. And now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns, while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We had little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale, the banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail, we will not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do. The bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many, you are the few.